observations on some of my visits overseas. I recall so vividly my very first visit to Latin America. I was privileged to address the International Cooperative League at Bogota, Colombia. Following that visit to Bogota, we were to go to Ecuador, to Peru, Chile, and the Argentine and Brazil. The visit was, in fact, like a revelation of a whole new world. I not only saw what people commonly call Latin America, but I saw people that had their own national cultures. The very obvious differences of attitude and opinion, of lifestyle. Yes, to be sure, with the exception of Brazil, where the common language is Portuguese, the language was Spanish. But the Chileans are as different from the Ecuadorians as the Swedes are from the Spaniards. And the Argentinians are as different from the Peruvians as the Americans would be from, let us say, the Cubans. Yet so many Americans in the North American area speak of Latin America as if it was one homogeneous area, one homogeneous entity. I think, that one visit taught me a basic lesson about the Southern Hemisphere, namely that countries had their own national identity, their own national heritage. They also had their own lifestyle, their own culture. And while there were many common denominators, there was even a larger number of differences. I often felt that our foreign policy did not relate to these differences, but all too often we thought of Latin America as if it was one area, one country, one culture, one heritage, one nationality. Furthermore, I noted in my visits to these countries that the emphasis in our foreign assistance program was so basically industrial. The foreign aid specialists that we were relying upon were highly trained economists from our great universities. The product of our highly urbanized, industrialized society. And understandably, their thoughts and their sense of direction in terms of economic development was towards the urban areas and the industrialization. Yet in these countries of Latin America, with their unique differences, while of course there were great cities such as Buenos Aires and Lima, Rio de Janeiro, Santiago, Valparaiso, Bogota, Quito, Quito, the majority of the people were rural and very poor. Also, while the common language was Spanish, there were large numbers of people who were of indigenous background, Indian population. And then in Chile and the Argentine and Brazil in particular, large numbers of people of European ancestry, Portuguese, Italian, German, in very large numbers. But despite all of these obvious differences, once that you visited the areas, our policy seemed to be on a course that took no recognition of the unique qualities and substantial differences in people, lifestyle, political heritage, and economic structure. As I returned from these visits, and I made several to Latin America between the 1950s and 1964, I made strong recommendations to the Department of State and our Mutual Assistance or Foreign Aid Administration that we concentrate our attention upon agricultural development, rural development, that we put first things first. The people of many of these countries, in all too many instances, were not ready in terms of education, technology, or social and economic background for rapid industrial development. At least the basic structure of the countries was rural, and that basic structure had to be strengthened, improved, and improved. The millions of people that lived in the rural areas were the victims, were the impoverished people, and yet they were the backbone of the respective countries. They needed help. They needed technical assistance. They needed education and health care. And above all, they needed the inspiration of hope and the promise of a better day. So my recommendations when I returned from these trips emphasized the rural character of the countries of Latin America, Central America, South America, and the importance of the use of the cooperative movement in our approach to rural development, housing, and the emphasis to be made upon education and health care and technical assistance. I have a feeling that we have wasted billions of dollars in so-called economic development, where people were not ready for it. There was all too little talent in the management area, too little skilled labor, far too little of what we call middle management, and only a thin surface structure of highly skilled professional talent. I have a feeling that we made some progress in these recommendations. As a member of the Committee on Foreign Relations, I was determined to amend and change our foreign assistance legislation to place the emphasis upon the rural areas. I developed a whole new section to foreign assistance known as Title V, emphasizing the use of the cooperative approach, the development of cooperatives, credit unions, consumer cooperatives, producers cooperatives, and savings and loan associations and credit unions. It was extremely difficult to get the executive branch of our government involved in this. I recollect that when we offered the amendment, there were less than a half a dozen specialists in the cooperative development in the Foreign Aid Administration. We had a host of people that were so-called superior economists, but all too few that truly understood what was happening in Latin America, and particularly in the respective countries, all too few who understood the rural character of the people and their many good qualities of hard work, sacrifice, patience, perseverance, and their limitations of illiteracy, poverty, disease, and a sense of hopelessness. In 1961, I visited the countries of Central America. I felt that as a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, greatly interested in our relationships with our neighbors to the south, that it was important for a member of the Committee on Foreign Relations to become better acquainted with what was happening in these small republics that we call Central America. Each of them so unique, each of them like a separate jewel in the crown of the family of nations. Of course, Mexico stands out as a separate area unto itself. Mexico is a great country, vast in area, populated with all the contradictions of wealth and poverty, of advanced learning and illiteracy, of productivity and inefficiency. Mexico has its own place in the sun, its own national identity, its own history, its own spirit. It can be compared to none other. It is unique in the family of nations in the Western Hemisphere. I sense that it has many growing problems. I sense then, as I do now, that it has many problems that ultimately must be faced. The urban masses and the rural poor exhibit every sign of social discontent. They are held in control by a highly organized political system with strong police powers and detailed political organization. But ultimately, the rural and urban poor will demand their share of the product of the nation. They will demand and they will get more of the benefits of a modern society, or there will be an upheaval of catastrophic proportions. Yet the Mexicans have such a spirit of nationalism, such a sense of national pride, that Mexico must be regarded as a truly great nation, and not as a weak and inconsequential republic. One of the prime responsibilities of any president of the United States is to keep in the close contact and intimate consultation with the political leaders of Mexico, and also to be fully aware of the social and political forces that are at work in the populace. This is just another way of saying that a president of the United States that is going to be aware of our national interests must not confine his attention merely to the current or temporary political leaders of any country, and particularly of Mexico, but also must be well informed, sensitive to, and aware of the economic and political forces that are at work underneath, over and beyond the established political structure. He must at least be informed of the dissident leaders, their background, their hopes and aspirations, their methods, and their tactics. I've always felt that our government was not adequately informed in these areas. We are so prone to pay attention to what is now rather than what may be tomorrow. National security and national interest cannot be equated with merely protecting the status quo, or not, or understanding and condoning and supporting the status quo. It must also include an awareness of, a realization of, and a sensitivity to the possibilities and the probabilities of things yet to come. Were we to follow this doctrine or policy, we would be much better prepared for changes that occur that seem like a dramatic surprise. Truly, there are very few surprises in the world of politics. Everything is visible. It's only whether or not those who are looking are able to see the whole scene. The tendency is to have a fixation upon a particular object, and in the instance of international relations, that object is all too often the government that is in power, rather than to see what is being governed and who are the people that are the constituents of the government or the subjects. In each of my visits abroad, I have constantly reminded our executive officials of the importance of keeping, of the importance of having officials in the executive branch who give careful attention to those individuals, political parties, social and economic forces that seem to be pressing upon the perimeters of the establishment. I recall going so far as demanding that the Secretary of State ask each American ambassador in any and all countries to present to the State Department a list of the guests that were invited to embassy receptions and American embassy occasions, parties, and dinners. I insisted that after that list had been reviewed, that the Secretary of State or the appropriate officer of the department instruct our ambassadors to include in these receptions, dinners, parties, and other occasions not only the prominent, well-known political and economic figures, but also those who appear to have the qualities of future leadership, or those who are the dissidents and the so-called troublemakers of the current times. I found in looking over some of these lists, as they were brought to my attention, that very few people of rural areas were ever invited to an embassy dinner. All too few leaders of organized labor, of youth groups, and of so-called dissident elements ever were brought into the circle of the American embassy. In other words, we enjoyed having the comfortable and the secure and the powerful in our midst, rather than those who were the discouraged, the disenchanted, and the weak, and the temporarily weak. And yet we have lived through a time in which social change is the pattern of the day, in which political revolution is as common as the seasons. We seem to ignore what is the obvious and content ourselves with what has been the tradition of the past. I made up my mind that if elected president, that I would pay special, that I would insist that our that government pay special attention to what I thought were the signs of the tomorrows and the future, the people yet to come into power, the forces on the make, in other words, bending the social political structure. And at the same time, of course, keeping proper relationships with the establishment and those that were in charge. It's a delicate assignment, and it would be difficult, but it is not impossible, and it is necessary. My visits to Central America, my visit to Central America in 1963 was a most enjoyable one. Seeing Honduras, its wooded lands, its mountains, its peasantry, and its intellectual elite was a revealing experience. And just to learn how to pronounce the name of the capital of Honduras, I considered a major triumph. Tegucigalpa. We'll have to learn, have to spell that out. Honduras, obviously, was not, what happened in Honduras was not going to change the world. But it was, at least, an indicator of the forces of change that were underway in the southern hemisphere. And then to go to Guatemala, a country that is in constant turmoil. Spanish people, a great Indian population, magnificent mountains and rivers and lakes, a beautiful countryside, indeed a paradise for a tourist, and yet a sea of poverty for its people, was an experience second to none. I was immediately impressed with the possibility of tourism from New York City to Guatemala City, and what this could mean to both of our, and what this could mean to the economy of Guatemala, as well as to a better understanding by the people of the United States for the people of Guatemala. My predictions in the 60s as to the revolutionary ferment in Guatemala were proven to be so accurate in the 1970s. Guatemala was a cauldron of revolution, terrorism, and discontent. And yet its great city, Guatemala City, was a beautiful Spanish-oriented capital with magnificent gardens, great and beautiful buildings, the high walls that surrounded the villas, and the magnificent metalwork of the gates and the ornamentation of an ornamentation period. But the countries that really fascinated me were Costa Rica and El Salvador. Little Costa Rica, a garden, if ever there was one. Soil so fertile that literally the fence posts grew like trees. This is no figure of speech. It is an objective observation. The truth is that as people cut down a tree to make a fence around their property, that the fence post that was driven into the ground literally grew and sprang forth with branches, leaves, and foliage. It was here that I saw some of the developments in low-cost housing for the local and rural, for the rural people. It was here where I saw a government that was sensitive to the needs of the people. And by the way, the people were beautiful. A mixture of the Western European, the Spaniard, the indigenous population. It is said that the Costa Ricans have the most beautiful women in all of Latin America. And I must confess that what I saw of the feminine, of femininity in my short visit to Costa Rica proved to me that the claim had considerable merit. While I was there, I met a number of the prominent political leaders that were to take control, that were to take charge of that country in the days ahead. Costa Rica is truly a democratic republic with a beautiful landscape, a healthy and strong people, with limited resources, but a sense of vitality that characterizes its entire life. And then little El Salvador. My visit there was brief, but again, I sensed the vitality of the people, a spirit of public happiness, despite their rather low standard of living. There is a beauty about these countries and their people that is hard to explain. It is a beauty of simplicity and yet of grace and decency, which leaves a lasting impression. Their problems, their economic problems, are immense. But obviously the people are determined not to permit their economic status to govern their values or to distort and diminish their joy of living. If ever I saw a people that were busily engaged in the pursuit of happiness, it was in these two countries of Costa Rica and El Salvador. And yet I must confess that there was so much that would ordinarily bring one unhappiness, so much that was visible and evident. But these people knew that man does not live by bread alone. Their love of family, their love of beauty, even in their poverty and their illiteracy, came through in clear and unmistakable identity. Came through clearly and unmistakably. When John Kennedy became president in 1961, many of the hopes and dreams that I had for our relationships with our neighbors in Central and South America began to take shape in terms of concrete in terms of policy and commitments. It was known as the Alliance for Progress. Kennedy had a unique attraction to the people of Latin America, of Central and South America. His spirit, his vivaciousness, his vitality, his smile, his style, was exactly what the Latin Americans adored needed, and admired. Latin American politicians and statesmen love to talk. They are truly great politicians, masters of the language, and as vociferous and loquacious as any American orator or as any American political orator or stump politician. They are a combination of a poet and a demagogue, of a spiritual leader and a revolutionary. Most of their politicians not only speak with the word and the tongue, but with the body, the eyes, the hands, the entire motion of the physical being, and the controlled emotion of the mind and the voice. They saw in Kennedy the poet and the politician, the dreamer and the pragmatist, the young of heart and the mature of mind. And to put it simply, they loved him. They adored him. When he announced his program called the Alliance for Progress, which in simple terms was to be a partnership between those of us in the United States and our neighbors to the south, in Latin and in Central and South America, it raised the hopes of the millions of people of that part of the world to a new high. It was inspiring, invigorating, challenging. And the message, and President Kennedy's message, reverberated throughout the continent, lifting the hopes of rich and poor, of peasant and urban dweller, of those in government and those who were suffering incredible poverty and pain. For many years, our attention had been directed towards Western Europe and the other parts of the world. Our neighbors to the south felt neglected, forgotten, and taken for granted. And it was Kennedy who said to them in simple language, "We are brothers and sisters. We are of the same family. We are of the Western Hemisphere. We must work together. We must stand together. We must be partners together." And the Alliance for Progress came alive, not only in spirit, but in form. There was the Inter-American Development Bank. There were the soft loans and the long-term loans. There were the new programs of developmental assistance and technical aid. And all at once, literally hundreds and thousands of North Americans swarmed over the countries of Latin America, working with their counterparts in establishing new programs of public health, education, housing, industrial development, the construction of communications, roads, ports, and a host of other economic development, economic and social improvements. What a wonderful beginning. The people were inspired and uplifted. And despite the rise of Castro in Cuba and the success of his revolution against the corrupt regime of Batista, and his insistence that he was going to export his revolution, the stature and the image of the United States in Latin America had improved had improved 100%, had improved to a degree that was unimaginable in terms of previous years. Kennedy was the friend of the campesino. Kennedy was the friend of the little people of Latin America. And in the hovels of the poor and in the homes of the rich, you could find the picture of President Kennedy and his lovely wife Jacqueline. In the homes of the devout Catholic would be the picture of Pope John or Pope Paul and John Kennedy. No American was ever more popular. No American president was more popular than Kennedy. No man ever had a greater hold on the people than Kennedy. They chanted his name. They sang his praises. They trusted him and loved him. He was both fact and fiction, myth and reality. But whatever it was, he meant something to them. Kennedy's death in 1963 was as much a shock and loss to the people of Central and South America as it was to the people of our own country. Literally millions wept. They had lost their hero. It wasn't that he was their president. It was that he was their hero, their hope. I believe there is a lesson to be learned in all of this. There's little doubt now that while our economic assistance was of substantial proportion, it did not relieve and it did not abolish or eliminate the conditions of poverty that were the common lot of so many people in these Latin American countries. But what was most important was that these same people who continued to live a very austere and impoverished life had someone they could believe in. They felt they had a friend in the United States, and that he was the big man, the important man, the president of the United States. I have a feeling that the common people of Latin America were even more in love with Kennedy than our own fellow Americans. He was Catholic, he was young, he was vivacious, he had a smile, they liked his style, he had class, he was vital, they loved his speeches, and they found in Jacqueline Kennedy a thing of beauty, someone that they could relate to, and someone that they loved. It isn't as if they knew him as a person or as a public figure. They had not touched him. They had not had the chance to be close to him in a physical sense. But the essence of the man, the aura of the man, the spirit of the man, spoke to them in such unmistakable terms that he was their leader, their hope, their salvation. And with his death, I believe, ended the Alliance for Progress. You see, the Alliance was only part of what was needed. Yes, to be sure, it was conceived as an economic and political partnership. But the Latins are a very subjective people, emotional and sentimental. They not only needed credits and technical assistance, loans, and public health, but they needed love, attention, affection, concern. And with Kennedy, they had that important part, the intangible part of the Alliance for Progress. With his death, they had lost this. And once again, we had to learn the hard way that money and technology that money and technology alone cannot change a world. That people do live by hope. That people need more than just the machines that man creates. They need the emotions and the passions that are a part of great leadership, that are so much a part of great leadership, that distinguish. Now let me move quickly to another period. I want to speak now of my reactions and feelings at the time that I took the oath of office when I became Vice President of the United States. Being elected Vice President of the United States was not just an ordinary election. I would be less than honest if I didn't say that I felt that a whole new period had come into my life. I suppose I might have, in a sense, overly reacted. I knew that it was going to be a demanding assignment, and yet I was so proud, so honored to be the Vice President of the United States. It had in a very real sense been an achievement beyond what I believed was possible, but not more than I'd hoped was possible. I was not naive about the nature of the office. I knew that to be Vice President was not to be, in any sense, the President of the United States. I knew that I was the Vice President in an administration that would be dominated by a powerful and unique man, Lyndon Johnson. I had known Johnson so well during the Senate days that I had no misconception on my part as to the nature of my role as a Vice President. And yet, you know, I'm sure that many of the people associated with me, my ever loyal and dedicated staff, had the feeling that somehow or another I was going to be an assistant president, not a vice president. That I was going to be in a position of great power. You could just see it in the reactions of those that were so much a part of my life. Bill Connell, my very loyal and truly gifted and talented administrative assistant. David Gartner, Max Campbellman, my secretary, Vi Williams. No, there wasn't any sense of arrogance or feeling uppity. It was just that we had entered a new stage in my political life, and when the lead player changes his role, the cast likewise changes its role. There was a new sense of caution on the one hand, and you had a feeling that you'd been elevated to a higher ground on another. There was the inevitable protective guard that was going up around the vice president, some of the people that used to get to see me would now be called out. Our constituency was a constituency of one, namely the president. And yet, just as the presidential staff guards, protects, and forwards and advances the president, so the vice presidential staff does the same thing. There's almost a rivalry right from the beginning between the two staffs, both of them doing their job, but both staffs protecting the interests of their principal. The very first challenge to the vice presidential staff was to be the location of our offices and the amount of space that we were to have. You would think this would be a The very first challenge to the vice presidential staff, its authority, its prestige, its power, was to be the location of our offices and the amount of space that we were to have. The location was quickly decided. It was to be in the executive office building where President Johnson had had his offices at the time that he was vice president. But the question was, would the new vice president, would Vice President Humphrey get the same amount of space as the former vice president, Lyndon Johnson? The answer came quickly, no, he would get less space. Well, of course, this was a moment of humiliation, not so much to the vice president as it was to the staff. And the battle was joined. The vice presidential staff, led by none other than Bill Connell, mapped out a battle plan, and between Bill Connell and David Gartner, the battle scene was underway. There were negotiations, confrontation, there was talk and visits, and finally what was to be a three-room suite was expanded to four rooms, and that was to be it. Connell was told in no uncertain words that this was all the space that was needed. It was as much as Lyndon Johnson had had, and surely Vice President Humphrey needed no more. Now, none of this came from the president directly, but it came from his executive assistant, who was obviously doing what he thought the president would want done, and at the same time was guarding, was keeping a proper balance between the relationship of the vice president and the president. But the vice presidential staff, like others, has a sense of domain and manifest destiny. They want more. They wanted more space. They wanted more attention. And they wanted better facilities. But every effort to get more space was quickly rejected. There just wasn't any more space, so the answer came. Even though staff members, the vice presidential staff members, had walked every hall of the executive office building, only to find that there were many rooms that were allocated to rather inconsequential commissions and agencies that surely didn't need the space that had been given to them. This infuriated, Bill Connell in particular and other staff members. It was the subject of considerable discussion. But the White House stood firm. There was to be no retreat from their position. Vice President Humphrey had as much space as Lyndon Johnson, and that was it. Finally, one of the staff members noted that an entrance to the executive office building was blocked, and that there was no use being made of the entrance that came in from the street that separated the White House from the executive office building. And there was a large foyer, unused space. Here would be a logical extension of the vice presidential facilities. All that was needed was to get clearance from someone, all that was needed was to get clearance from the White House, that a wall could be put in, a door could be put in, and that what was once an entrance area could be converted into an additional office space. And weeks of negotiation took place. A new battle plan was drawn up. And there were discussions with everybody from Marvin Watson to Jack Valenti to Bill Moyers to George Reedy to the entire White House staff. The general in charge of these field operations was none other than Bill Connell. He was backed up by the quiet but persevering David Gartner. He would send his shock troops headed by Connell would send his shock troops headed by Ted Van Dyke and Bill Welch. And finally, the White House yielded. It said, go ahead, add the extra room. But that was it. There would be no more. It was final. Well, this was a victory of no inconsequential proportions. The staff was delighted. We had finally won out. But the victory was only short-lived, because soon we were to find out that some of the emoluments of office were only to be ours by sufferance and through the generosity of the White House itself. I refer to the use of automobiles. After all, the vice presidential staff felt it. Bill Connell, David Gartner, Ted Van Dyke, Bill Welch, and others felt they ought to have the right to use the automobiles from the executive office carpool. And from time to time, they would call for a car to take them to their home or to a meeting and maybe to a social gathering. The word soon reached the ever observant Marvin Watson or some other member of the White House staff. And it wasn't long before the order went out, no cars for the vice president's office, except for the administrative assistant, Bill Connell. And then only on his daily request, not a car to be assigned, not a driver to be his, but he was to have a car when he needed it. But as for the rest of them, taxis were available, or hopefully a ride with Connell or the vice president or someone else. That's why the vice presidential staff was to learn that the good things of life were not theirs by right, but theirs by the order of the president. He who giveth can taketh away. And believe me, there was some giving and there was some taking away. Well, such were the early days in the vice presidential office. The staff settled down, however, to its duties, and in short order we had a well-functioning establishment. Our relationships with the men across the street at the White House were basically good. Fortunately, Bill Connell had lived in Texas, and since there were many Texans in the White House, there was a common bond of interest and friendship. Cannell was welcomed, Cannell was well received. But with Van Dyck, it was another matter. Ted Van Dyck is a talented, brilliant, peripatetic, eager man, peripatetic and eager man. He had little time for small talk. He was a man of action. He wanted to get things done. And time after time, he would be infuriated with what he thought were the unnecessary delays of clearance over at the White House. I recall in 1966, when I was given the responsibility by the president to do some campaigning for Democratic candidates for Congress, working under the auspices of the Democratic National Committee. It was Ted Van Dyck who lined up the plane, who along with Bill Cannell organized the campaign operation. And it was Ted who was handling some of our public relations in his own inimitable style of no small talk, quick action, get things done. He was a can-do man. I was going to make some tapes. I was asked by candidates to do some tapes, videotapes, for their local radio programs. I was also to do a special broadcast for one of the networks. And the next thing I know, Ted Van Dyck has ordered a television crew to put a cable across the street into the White House and down into one of the rooms in the west end and in the west end of the White House itself. Well, believe me, had someone been planting a bomb in the basement of the White House, it couldn't have caused more commotion. Within an hour after the cable had been laid across the street, brought into the White House, and all of the apparatus for the television show had been put in place, the word came from Marvin Watson to get that damn thing out of here and get it out of there quick, that the president would have none of this. Who was it that authorized this laying of the cable? What member of the vice presidential staff was stupid enough to do something like this? It was as if that we had plotted the overthrow of the government. And Ted Van Dyck soon learned that no matter how brilliant he was, how determined he was to see that Democrats would be elected, how diligent and persevering he was in his many tasks, that he had to take orders. Frankly, I didn't know that he'd put the cable in. And when I heard about it, I knew what would be the reaction across the street. And the reaction came like a blast out of the east, blowing Ted Van Dyck right back into his office and the cable into the middle of the street. And the campaign videotapes down the drain. Just another example of who runs the show. Now those are some of the, of who was running the show. I couldn't help but laugh about it, because I heard that the cable was in, I myself was very upset, was plenty upset with Ted, because I knew what the reaction would be, and I also knew that it would get me in trouble, which indeed it did, but not for long. President could be angry, but he was also forgiving. However, it was just one more of those little incidents that brought tighter control from the White House to the office of the Vice President. For example, if you needed a boat to take some people out on a cruise on the Potomac, or if you wanted to schedule the use of one of the Jetstars, the executive fleet, air fleet, you cleared it with the White House. In other words, you cleared it with Marvin. The President had given strict rules, had given strict orders that no one in any part of the government was to have the use of any of the equipment without direct approval from the White House. And it's understandable. And when I look back at it, I'm sure that it was desirable. After all, there is always a tendency on the part of people in official position to demand more than the situation requires, to use the luxury items like planes and boats more than was really needed. And President Johnson had no intention of having his cabinet or the vice president or any other official of his administration using executive equipment, executive vehicles, cars, boats, or planes without direct approval from his executive assistant, Marvin Watson. However, we were seldom denied any request. There might be a delay, and sometimes the delays were infuriating to the staff, but ultimately the request was honored. Many was the time that I was able to use either the Honey Fitz or the Patrick J. riverboat to take out members of the Congress, foreign dignitaries, or in just friends and visitors that would come to Washington. Most of the time, the river boats were used by cabinet officers to work with the committees of the Congress, key congressional leaders, and of course people that had vital interest in legislation from the private sector. These boats were on the river practically every day, and seldom just for the fun of it. Lyndon Johnson was always able to mix work and fun. He would expect results no matter what you were doing, and he had a way of knowing what you were doing that was almost more pervasive than the FBI itself. I've never known a man who could have his fingers in so many things at one time, who had such an insatiable sense of inquiry, who wanted to know so much about so many things, and who enjoyed knowing all the little bits of gossip that were going around Capitol Hill or through the social ranks of Washington. And believe me, he knew what was going on. I suppose this is best illustrated by the fact that in his office, as well as in his bedroom, he had three television sets, one for each network, CBS, NBC, and ABC. In the morning, if you'd come to see him for breakfast, you would generally meet him in the bedroom while he was getting dressed. The televisions would be on, and with his little clicker that would tune in the voice from one set to another, he could cover the news of each network even as he was adjusting his necktie and putting on his trousers. If Lyndon Johnson was ever alone, it most likely was when he was asleep. He wanted people around him. He devoured people. He used people. He liked people. And he insisted on their company. He was particularly restless when Lady Bird would be out of the city. Then he seemed to be like a caged tiger. He would pace the White House and call up his friends, particularly his old Texas friends, and frequently Muriel and myself, asking us over to lunch, to breakfast, to dinner, or to a show, or anything else. He simply needed to have someone around to talk to and to be with. He would bounce off his ideas. He would see what kind of a reaction he would get. And right in the midst of a conversation, he might very well pick up a telephone and give someone a long-distance call. He was the most unpredictable man in many ways. And yet, if you were to see him early in the morning, you would sense that in all of this, what appeared to be confusion of activity, a whole battle plan for the day was being mapped out. He would be reading documents, looking at the television, talking to you, giving orders left and right, having members of his staff come in, and laying out the plan for the day in the minutest detail. But then all those plans would more or less would frequently suffer, because if the president found someone during the day that he enjoyed talking to, a 15-minute appointment could well be extended into a half hour or an hour. And many times the visitor would be just asked to stay on. I've seen occasions where a visitor came to call on the president in the morning before the day and would be with the president through the entire day late into the evening. No, that didn't mean that he was at the president's side, but he would be in and around the White House at the beck and call of the president. He'd see the president a few minutes, and then he'd be asked to leave for a while. He'd be only to be asked again to join the president for a sandwich at lunchtime, or to stick around and have a swim later on in the day. Members of Congress have told me that they would be called by the president to join him on a trip out into their home state, only to find out that once they were aboard the plane, that the president was planning on stopping at two or three states. So what was scheduled to be a one state visit for a congressman would end up being a three or four state journey that would last from early morning until late at night. Newspaper reporters never knew when the president was going to move. If you came in the west gate of the White House, in the west entrance of the White House, you would see a line of suitcases there in the entryway. These were ready packed, because the president would move almost without advance notice, at most giving a half hour to an hour, just to alert the press so they could get ready to board the plane. He had a penchant, a desire for secrecy that was almost beyond understanding. I'm sure that he must have informed his most intimate staff members of his plans, but seldom, if ever, did the press know, and all too often, the vice president didn't know. Johnson was a man like the change of seasons and the change of weather. He could be warm, and then he could turn chilly. He could be moody, and then he could be filled with sunshine and radiance. You would be with him in what appeared to be a regular, well-organized meeting, and lo and behold, he'd be taking off someplace with very little notice. It was sort of like living in the eye of the storm, but occasionally the calm would give way to a tornado of activity. He was always busy. They tell the story, which I'm sure is true, that once when he was at the ranch, he came out to visit He came out to visit some of the members of the Secret Service in their trailer, and he found three or four of them just sitting there. And he said to them, "Why aren't you busy? Why aren't you doing something?" To which they replied, "Well, Mr. President, luckily today we don't have any troubles. There's not much to do." To which the president replied, "Well, for God's sakes, do something. Kill flies, or do something, but don't just sit there." I think this typifies so much what President Johnson was like. He wanted things to happen. Now, speaking of the ranch, this is a chapter in the president's life and in the life of his friends and visitors that is separate and distinct from any other thing that relates to the man. I recall on the day that I was on the day after the Atlantic City Convention in 1964, without any pre-notice, Muriel and I were informed by the president that he wanted us to come to the ranch with him down in Texas. And lo and behold, he literally lifted off the ground the publisher of the Washington Post, Catherine Graham. She protested that she just didn't have her clothes packed, that she wasn't ready to go, that she hadn't called anybody to her office, that she simply couldn't go, to which the president paid absolutely no attention. He literally picked her up and said, "On the plane, Katie, we're going to Texas, and I want you with me." Our youngest son, Douglas, was with Muriel and I, and I'm sure that he'll never forget that trip. We were off and gone before you even knew that the trip had been, before you'd even own that the trip had been planned. And in short order, we were in Texas at the ranch. The president was a different man the minute that he touched ground in Texas. He loved the hill country. He loved his ranch. It was his private preserve. There was nothing too big or too small for him to give, for him to deny it attention. If the fence was not straightened, he would be calling on the intercom system, direct from his car. To his ranch foreman, asking him to fix it up. If a gate wasn't fastening properly as he passed by, he would ask that it be repaired. He would be checking the cattle. He'd be looking over the roads. He'd be doing everything that was possible to be done by any one set of eyes or any one human being. And words would be flashed out over the communication system to the Secret Service, to his foreman, or to anyone else that was near a loudspeaker. He had a direct connection from his car, of course, to the Secret Service station at the ranch, and also to his home. There was a communication system in the kitchen of the ranch house, and he could be talking to the cook even as he was driving the car, asking what was going to be on the table for supper, literally preparing the menu as we were going down the road. You just can't believe it unless you could see it. You couldn't understand it unless you experienced it. And he wanted to drive his own car. None of this Secret Service business of handling the car. He would jump into his white Lincoln and tear across the fields with reckless abandon. He never worried whether there was a road in front of him or behind him. He just would move. If ever there was a test for an automobile, Lyndon Johnson tested the Ford Motor Company's finest product, the Lincoln. He loved that car. and he would drive it at breakneck speeds, particularly on the main highways, and with not much less speed, out across country roads and through the farmlands. Then you'd get to the ranch house, and here he was king. The first thing he would do is to show all of his guests around. They would see the house, the guest house, the swimming pool. They would see the airplane that was in his barns or hangar, the airstrip where the planes could land. He gave you a full tour, personally conducted. And if you didn't have clothes, he'd proceed. If you didn't have clothes to wear that he thought were appropriate for the ranch, he'd proceed into his bedroom and into the into his closets and pull out shirts and pants and boots, whether they would fit you or not, and say, "Put them on," and get you all attired for what was supposed to be a day of peace and quiet at the ranch. It was just about as peaceful as a hurricane and as quiet as a thunderstorm. But I can tell you that it was exciting. Nearby the ranch was a lake. As a product of the early days of conservation and water conservancy. It was one of those man-made lakes, but it was a big one. And on that lake, the president had his own boat. No one was going to drive it but the president. And he would take off as if it were jet-propelled, full steam ahead, making sharp turns with reckless abandon again, and then proceeding to show you some of the houses that had been built along the lakeshore. One that he had built for Jack Valenti and Margaret Mary, a lovely little home. And he was just as proud of that house as if he were living in it himself. He would take you into the kitchen and show you that the refrigerator was filled with pop and ginger ale and oranges and orange juice and anything else that is supposed to be in a refrigerator. And then he would recall him telling us that that Arthur and Matilda Quim, two of his dearest friends, had purchased property in the nearby area near the lake and close to the ranch, and that they were building a house. He wanted all of his friends there. I'm sure if he'd had his way, he'd had a house for everybody that he knew, and that he included into his circle of close friends. He was the kind of a man that wanted people, his people, yes, the Johnson people around him. He wanted them close at hand. He wanted to have something to say about their lives. He wanted to be involved with them, and they'd be involved with him. It was almost like he was a benevolent dictator or a kindly king that was watching out for, taking care of the wants and the needs of each and every one of his kinfolk and his close associates, but doing it his way, not their way, because he knew that his way was the best way. Then, of course, close to the ranch, he had restored his old family home, and he was so proud of this. And he was so proud of it. Everything from the pump in front of the house and the well to the bedroom in which he was, everything from the pump in front of the house to the porch to the kitchen, the bedroom, and the living room, all restored just as it was when he was a boy. A great deal of his time and effort went into this. He would, even when he was back at the White House, he would frequently call home to see how the repairs were coming and the renovation. And then, of course, there was cousin, I've forgotten her name for a minute, we'll fill it in. She lived right down the road from the Johnson place. And the president took great pride in the fact that he'd fixed up this house for her, fixed up her house so that it would be a little more comfortable for her. He loved his family. He gave them lots. He gave them a good deal of attention, and always was bringing them into his conversation. There isn't any doubt but what President Johnson found great comfort and strength in the hill country and his ranch, the hill country of Texas and his ranch home. When he'd get weary in Washington, he'd pack up and fly down to Texas. The press didn't like it particularly because there really wasn't much of a place to stay except in Johnson City or Austin. And Austin was some 40 miles away from the Johnson house. So it was inconvenient for the press. And what's more is they generally liked a little more nightlife and social activity than was available in a town like Johnson City. But be that as it may, they had to follow the president wherever he went. And whenever he had any free time, it was back to Texas for him. It was here that he saw his old friends. Here where he could play dominoes, here where he could ride in his car and survey his land and look at his cattle. He knew those cattle like most people would know their children. He knew how many calves had been born in the last month. And even when he was back at the White House, he'd pick up that telephone and call the ranch foreman to see whether or not a particular calf had survived, or how things were, or whether and what the price of feed was, and whether they were getting enough feed. There was a drought at one time in Texas during his presidency, and he was terribly worried over the water supply and the feed supply. No matter what the international situation was or what the problems were in Washington, he would find some time during the day to be in direct contact with his ranch foreman, inquiring as to the condition of the cattle, the condition of the land, whether or not the hay had been brought in, and all the many things that go on with farm life. Yes, he was several people, not just one or two people. He was the president with all of the responsibilities. He was the husband with his way of treating his wonderful wife, Lady Bird. He was the father with Lucy and Linda. And then he was the hale, hearty, well-met big man with his Senate, with his old friends and buddies from Texas and other parts of America. And then he was the leader with the members of Congress and the dominating personality in every conversation and every meeting. But he could be a good listener as well as a non-stop chain talker, particularly when he was in the presence of people from industry and commerce and labor. He would pull them out. He would drag out of them information that I'm sure they never expected to give him. He would pose questions for them that would make them think as they'd never had to think before. And he would soon have them involved in his endeavors so that they became an intimate part of his official activities. Muriel and I had many visits to the ranch. It's almost like a blur as you look back at it, but some things stand out. The president would be at the head of the table. There would be the moment of grace, and then just as surely as you were taking a breath, he'd be reaching down to pick up the phone and to give someone a call. Names must have flashed through his mind like a lightning in a stormy sky, and he would be in contact with someone nearby in Texas or someone in Washington, or he would have had one of his secretaries put in a long-distance call for someone that he wanted to talk to, even as we were eating lunch or supper. He combined things, to put it mildly. It wasn't just that you sat down for supper or dinner, and he called it supper. It wasn't just that you were going to have lunch with the president. You were going to experience a full day in 1 hour. everything from meetings to discussions to sociability and food to argument and meditation. It was all there. And if you couldn't take it, the best thing for you to do was to find a good excuse to leave, because the president had the day mapped out for you, and the time of the visit, and the time of the visit under his total control. I shall never forget after the convention of 64, when we arrived at the ranch. All the photographers were there and the pressmen, and the president decided that I should get dressed up as if I were a Texas rancher. He gave me a pair of pants, the leg of big enough for a man twice my size, a jacket that was for a man a shirt far too big for me, and a Texas hat made for him and surely not for me. And then he said, "Now, Hubert, get on that horse. We're going for a ride." Well, while the amount of horseback riding that I had done was limited to two or three little excursions with the children on a horse tame enough to be safe at a children's picnic. And he put me on a horse that was larger than any I'd ever ridden, spirited, and the next thing I know, there's 100 cameramen out in front of me flashing their bulbs, and the horse rearing up on his hind legs, and me hanging on for dear life. That's the picture that appeared. A vice president riding horseback, trying to demonstrate both courage and trying to demonstrate his personal courage, trying to prove his personal courage and his equestrian ability. And I'm afraid that the image of courage didn't come through, but rather one of awesome fear. And as far as an equestrian image, it appeared I was more like a child that was getting his first ride on a merry-go-round and hanging on for dear life. The president got a big kick out of it. He always teased me about being a farm boy and then reminded me that I surely must not have done much work on the farm because I knew seemed to know so little about it. And then there was the time that we went down to see the president, and we went hunting, deer hunting. And again, not deer hunting by walking out into the woods or into the plains, but getting into the Lincoln and driving slam bang and lickety split across the country early in the morning, while he was pointing out the window at the deer here and there. He had lots of deer on his place. And all at once the brakes would slam on and he'd say, "Hubert, there's one for you, get it." And I remember my reluctance in shooting a deer. I've never liked to hunt animals. But here I was with Lyndon Johnson, and this time he... And as usual, he was outlining, as usual, he had planned the day and was giving the orders. And I pulled up the rifle and let fire. And lo and behold, I got myself a deer. To which he reminded me, "Well," he said, "Bobby Kennedy got two of them. You're not going to let Bobby get the best of you, are you?" And we charged down the road again until we sighted another deer. He said, "Now's your chance. You can be as good as Kennedy if you can hit that one." Lo and behold, I was able to hit it. He said, "That's enough." He said, "You've shot one more than McCarthy and the same number as Bobby. You're in good shape." I said, "Mr. President, what in the world am I going to do with those deer?" He said, "Don't you worry. I'll make them into sausage and into venison steaks, and you will have them. Also, I'll see that you get the antlers. All of which he did. The antlers were brought to Washington, and the deer sausage was prepared at the Johnson Ranch, and the venison steaks were all delivered. We had enough meat to supply a family of our size for 2 years. Enough meat to supply a family of ours for 2 years. My biggest job from there on out was how to divide it up, and at the same time not to let the then Vice President Johnson know that I had given away most of the deer meat that he had so generously prepared and delivered to the Humphrey home. Well, we had lots of fun. Those memories of the visits to the ranch will be a unique chapter will be a special chapter in our lives. You were one of the many actors on the Lyndon Johnson stage. At times you were just an extra, but you were a part of the scene. He would parade across that stage his friends, his relatives, his old cronies, and he would recite his lines of his experiences as a youth in the school, as a school teacher, and as a student at San Marcos State College. He would tell of the days that he went to California as a boy leaving home, and talk to you of his mother and his father and of the other members of his family, and particularly of his aunts and his uncles. It was perfectly obvious that he just loved the ranch area, the hill country, and those neighbors of his. He never forgot them. He involved them in every part of his life. And so many times as you would visit with the president, he would relate his current political activities to the experiences he had in those earlier days in Texas. He was particularly proud to have served that district in the Congress of the United States. He would remind you that he got one of the first REA programs in the country going in his district.